Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and still practices on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a five-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com to learn more about the show or download a free prescription for naloxone. Carrying naloxone for drugs is like carrying an EpiPen for allergies. Today's episode is sponsored by Families Against Fentanyl. FAF is an organization set on attacking the supply chain of deadly illicit fentanyl. To learn more, visit familiesagainstfentanyl.org and sign their petition to declare illicit fentanyl a weapon of mass destruction. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for a trauma conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. Trauma, not like where I work, an emergency department with a level one trauma center. I'm talking about a different kind of trauma, life trauma, with adversities such as being bullied, insulted, humiliated. Physical trauma such as being slapped, pushed, or worse. Feeling unloved is a type of trauma. Divorce is a trauma. And that's just the mild stuff. Researchers found that a high ACE score or adverse childhood experiences could be linked to higher likelihood of health challenges, including drug use later on in life. ACEs are interesting. I'm blessed with a low ACE score, but then I thought, what if I apply the ACE principle to my job? Instead of adverse childhood experience, adverse career experience. That's also an ACE. As an emergency physician, I have been criticized for being too fast, too slow, ordering too many tests, too little tests, threatened, assaulted, and sued. I have a very high ACE score for my job. Not surprisingly, emergency physicians rank number one in burnout compared to other physicians. But things are not so simple. People can have a high ACE score and live a healthy, positive, productive life. And I have a high work ACE score, and yet I still love my job after 30 years. The issue of trauma and trauma-informed care is becoming more important in medical treatment as well as preventing workplace burnout. To learn more about trauma-informed care, I reached out to Brooke Brigance. Brooke Brigance is an expert in trauma-informed care. She is certified in grief recovery, mental health first aid, and trauma-informed systems and practices. We're going to learn what all that means. She serves as the director of the Cypress Resilience Project and the co-director of FACES for the Future, both programs at Public Health Institute in Oakland, California. She regularly supports various organizations with focus on trauma-responsive practices, including managing toxic stress, cumulative grief, and burnout. To learn more about Brooke Brigance, check out the High Truth show notes. Brooke Brigance, welcome to High Truths.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
I'm so excited to have you. I've been waiting this. This is going to be a fascinating conversation, something that probably applies to all of us. But you are a expert in trauma. So explain to us, how did that come about for you? You didn't like wake up one day and say, I want to be an expert in trauma.
No. No. So I come from intergenerational trauma and so have lived experience as well, and have always been interested in the subject. I actually was working for a program at Public Health Institute that was a health career pipeline program for historically underrepresented young people at high school level. And my colleague and I, Jasmine Nakagawa and I, we started talking one day about what were some of the things we felt were stopping the young people we serve from achieving their goals and things like that. And the first thing we landed on was we thought they were grieving. They were grieving different life events and they didn't really have any kind of answer for that. And so we became grief recovery method specialists and we kind of wanted to learn more about grief. And then we got some opportunities through Alameda County in the Oakland area to become mental health first aid instructors. And so we were like really diving into mental health and working in community and starting to train people on mental health first aid. And then I was like, okay, so we have mental health, we have grief, but what about trauma? And we know that there's so much intersectionality there in lived experience. And so I also became a trauma-informed systems trainer and specialist with Alameda County, and went through that process. And then we decided, well, this work needs a home. And so we created the Cypress Resilience Project at Public Health Institute, and Cypress went live, if you will. I think our website went live in February of 2020. And then, of course, the pandemic hit. And so we've been just going ever since.
Wow. And you said that you have a personal connection to that. Are you doing well with that? We just want to make sure that you're...
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that it's most of the people on the Cypress team have lived experience of some sorts or others. And I think that it's part of how we're able to create safe space for people in these conversations, because we can relate and empathize with some of the things that folks are going through. And so, yeah, but I'm doing really well. It's never something that you're completely finished with, I don't think. You're still having constant conversation with yourself about how to support your wellness and healing and all of those sorts of things. But yeah, I think I appreciate you asking. That's the doctor in you, right?
Yeah. And I know that you're a mom, and I'm wondering how that affects your parenting. Knowing what you do and how you raise your children.
It's so interesting, because at Cypress, we say everyone is somebody, right? Like, everyone has people in our personal lives. So you can have a lot of training in your professional life, and then when you get home, you know, some of that learning goes out the window. So I'd love to say I'm a perfect parent, because the training I have, I'm not, by any stretch of the imagination.
No, but one is.
But we always want to be, right? Like, that's the one job we always wanted to be the best at. I'm certainly not perfect, but I do think that I am able to talk to the boys, and we're able to have some dialogues that feel truthful and honest and healing, and that's been a real joy. So they're all older now, they're adults, but going through all of those years with them and now seeing the amazing people they've become is just such a joy.
Oh, that's very nice. That's great to hear. Now, I remember when we talked before, I was fascinated that there is actually a physiology to trauma. Can you explain that? The things happen to the brain, or what goes on?
Yeah, I mean, this is certainly not me coming up with this. So there's so many wonderful resources out there. People often sort of speak to The Body Keeps Score by Bessel van der Kolk as kind of that brain 101. I worked in a department of neurology for some time when I lived in New York, and I was always interested in neurology and understanding how to interpret behavior through that lens. And it's really, I think, benefited my approach to this work to understand how brains work. I think a couple of key factors that are, certainly everyone is discussing is the fact that there is dysregulation in the brain when we go through these events. I think the other thing that's important, especially now, is that when we talk about trauma, a lot of times people think of acute trauma or big one-time events, that thing that happened on Thursday. But trauma is also a series of events and a set of circumstances that are activating the brain's stress response. And so it doesn't have to be one big, huge thing that happened. It can be simply living in a set of circumstances that include threat. And so, that's...
Can you give us some examples?
Yeah, like housing insecurity, food insecurity, bullying, living with someone who feels like they don't have your back. There's a lot of just potentiality of threat in the environment, just as being a person. But then when you add in other factors, I often talk about the fact that brains are hunter-gatherer brains. We were intended to be around a campfire. And then we were supposed to get hungry, so we would go out and get food. We would encounter a threat out there. It was supposed to be short-lived because we were going to do something about that threat. We would maybe die or we would survive, and we were supposed to come back connected and be together. And then that's when we celebrated the fact that we were alive. We made baskets and cooked the food together and danced and made music. And so when you think about it, disruptions to that, there are all different kinds of life experiences that could count as trauma for the brain.
And when we're talking about that, I know when they look at ACE scores, adverse childhood experiences, it's generally 18 and under, and is that true in general when you're talking about that? So if you had a synagogue shooting as an adult, does that still count as a trauma?
Absolutely, absolutely. I think that there are a couple of factors for childhood adversity that feel important. One of them is that the neural pathway of trauma is deeper in the brain the more helpless we feel when that event occurs. And so that's part of the reason why, I mean, what can you do when you're 7 or 8? You have no autonomy, right? So you're not able to actually create some sort of strategy to manage that trauma. The other thing is the relationships around you to help you cope with that traumatic event matter a lot. And when you look at the adverse childhood experience score sheet, a lot of it is about the world of adults surrounding that child, right? What kind of stress are they undergoing? What kinds of mental health issues or addiction issues do they have? And so it means that they're perhaps the adults around that young person are limited in their abilities to support the child through the traumatic event itself. So that I think there's a couple different factors there.
Interesting. Now, back to the brain and trauma. I mean, people who've had trauma, can you get a CAT scan or MRI or PET scan and see things?
Yeah, so there's really interesting work actually being done on brain scans and things like that. We also have PET scan images that show that when that is activated, the prefrontal cortex, or that executive function part of the brain that I always say it builds bridges and does algebra, right? Like it's the part of the brain that people think of as most human, if you will. It's building connections, got a lot of language in it. It actually goes dark. PET scans show that it goes dark and the limbic system starts to light up when someone is in that state. Limbic system is all about survival and emotion. That's its job. So it's analyzing your environment. It's keeping track of your senses. I always say to someone, if I set a rattlesnake in your room where you are right now, Dr. Lev, you wouldn't be listening to me anymore,
No.
right? You would be listening for that rattle, and that would be all you would care about, right? And so I think that, I think brain imaging and scanning is going to lead us into a lot of really amazing places. We understand so much more now than we did before. And, the neurological studies just continue to give us more information day to day. It's an ever-changing landscape. It's very exciting.
Wow. And you also talked about the DNA.
Yeah.
And tell us about that.
Yeah, that's another area of inquiry that I'm so excited about because we just learn more and more every day about how we are impacted epigenetically. So really our DNA being informed by the trauma experiences of our ancestors. Really specifically, thinking about how the DNA unravels and its connection to chronic diseases. So there's a lot of important information neurologically about what goes wrong. I think there's also a growing body of work about how that same epigenetic, sort of transferal is also around resilience. We're also inheriting the resilience and the coping strategies of our ancestors. So it's not all, you know, negative news. It's also really positive, good news. We've inherited a lot in both directions from those who came before us, which is important to remember, especially if you know you have intergenerational trauma, because that can feel a little overwhelming, right? To kind of sit with and think about, how did the trauma of my family affect my genetics? And I kind of came preloaded with this. And then on top of that, maybe, you know, lived experience has been added on a personal level. That's a lot to hold on to.
It's fascinating that you should say that it's, you know, connected to your DNA and your ancestors. And I'm wondering if that's why on October 7th of this year, of last year, for a lot of Jewish people around the world, something woke up, like this fear, this survival, this like, here we go again, even though in our generation, we really had it pretty good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And studies have shown that the more something is happening to people who look like you, sound like you, that you relate to, the more your brain receives that as an actual threat to you. Right. So that all of the different I get very concerned about the access that we have to video documentation of trauma. You can't open a social media app right now without seeing videos of traumatic events. And the more my brain relates to the people that that's happening to, the more it reads it as a potential threat to self, which makes a lot of sense. Right. If it can happen to them, it can happen to me. Right. Like, yeah. So. Right. Yeah. So when you're inundated day after day after day with scrolling through content that is incredibly graphic and scary, your brain says, hey, that's really bad for you, not just for the people it's happening to.
Right. And yet media is intended to do that, right? You're not going to click on it if it's just some boring story. It's meant to, yeah. It's meant to, you know, to activate you, otherwise, for you to read more. Otherwise, why even? And I don't know what the answer to that is, except sometimes you just shut it off. Like, don't look, you know?
It's one of the things that I say to folks is, if you know that you are going through a particularly stressful time, if you are already feeling burned out, if you have lived experience, think about how you consume the information that you're trying to consume. You can still be an aware citizen. People want to know what's going on in the world. Do you have to watch the graphic video that accompanies it? That's the question I ask.
Brooke, have you heard of the NN diet?
No.
My husband, I think, made that up. NN, no news diet.
No news. Yeah. Yeah. Or at least like print news. How about that? You know, maybe we stick to the paper for a while.
If the world is ending or something, let me know. But otherwise, I don't want to hear about it.
Yeah. And I think it's a significant concern. The other sort of problem with that is that when we are in really high levels of stress, one of the brain's reactions to that is freeze. Right. And so I hear a lot in the conversations around burnout and toxic stress. I'm able to get through Monday through Friday, 9 to 5, but then I get home and I freeze. And that shows up for people as what folks are calling doom scrolling, which is just that constant, you know, sort of taking in information. And what did I just say the limbic system does? It's analyzing our environment. Right. So all the video, all of that is going, it's stuff that we see, that we hear. It has an impact.
Yeah. We're going to get into the whole burnout issue in a minute, but I want to just about the brain. You were also mentioning that the brain can repair itself.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. I think it's amazing, right? Like brains relearn how to do things. And we know that from different types of injuries to the brain, right? If someone has a stroke, occupational therapy is in there helping that person relearn how to do activities of daily living, the brain finds detours. It finds a new way to learn how to tie my shoes, or it learns a new way to, hold a fork or write a thank you note. And so that same plasticity is available to us for other types of activities. So, for example, learning how to have vulnerable feelings in the proximity of another person, learning how to properly assess my environment. There's lots of different things that the brain can learn and relearn, which is, I always think, incredibly encouraging and hopeful.
Wow. So you're saying after a stroke, you get physical therapy and occupational therapy, but, with trauma, you can get the equivalent of PTOT and repair things.
Absolutely. Yeah. That plasticity, we have cellular plasticity until about 25, 26 years old. But we continue to learn new routes for things our entire lives.
That's right. You don't get new neurons. Those are fixed, but each neuron has dendrites that can grow in different directions and you can compensate.
And there's no time limit on that. So that's the good news too, right? Because if you have a trauma background and you're sitting listening to this right now and you're 45, you may think, ugh, what am I supposed to do about that? Good news is there's lots you can do.
Yeah, at any age. What about prevention? And maybe I were alluding to that when I asked you about, as a mom, how do you deal with things with your kids? But knowing about trauma, knowing that once you have a problem, it can be fixed. You could get, physical therapy for your brain for trauma. But how about prevention?
I think it's huge. And there are lots of folks out there doing really good upstream thinking about how to build resilience in communities preemptively. A lot of that work has been focused on natural and man-made disaster. So thinking about climate change and forced displacement due to natural disasters as a norm, and thinking about how to build community resilience preemptively. But there's also really good conversation about how to do that, for example, in a school, bless you, knowing that we're doing active shooter drills in schools, right? And we can at the same time be building collective and community resilience within the school. So if there were to be a trauma, the community's ability to heal from that is much greater than if we only come in after the fact. So there's a lot of really great work being done on building community resilience and individual resilience preemptively.
Are there examples of schools that have this in their curriculum?
Yeah, so there's a lot of important work being done there. You'll often hear that talked about as social emotional learning. There's a lot of restorative justice practice that's being used in schools. There's lots going on in schools in particular. I think it's all very exciting. The reason for it is, frustrating and upsetting, but I think there's good, there's lots and lots of schools that are engaged in various types of this work. And I think that schools are a great place for us to spend time and energy and effort, because those young people, that's, an important population to serve and to build resilience with trauma as a potential reality for them.
Interesting. All right. So trauma informed care. That's the expertise. And we talk about that. Well, we want trauma-informed care, but what does that mean?
Yeah, so I think it's a spectrum of things. A lot of folks talk about there being kind of a spectrum of responses. So folks will talk about trauma sensitivity, meaning I just kind of make an assumption it's in the room. And then I'm going to be, trauma kind of informed in my interpersonal interaction with you. So if I believe that trauma is very often in the room with me, I'm going to work to create safe space, build trust and transparency with people, et cetera. So then I'm honed in on skill building for myself. How do I do that? How do I make, this particular interaction with someone feel safe for them and not re-traumatize them? Trauma-informed work is often systems work. So that's the work that where you're really going to dig into things like policies, practices, procedures, how an organization or an agency, an institution functions. And then trauma-responsive work is all of that that is then self-reflective. So we are constantly looking at policies, practices, culture, building, et cetera. We're gaining skills in terms of our interpersonal interaction. We're never making assumptions about who does and doesn't have trauma. And we are building those systems and conditions within our organization to take care of people, not only who come through the door as a client or a patient, but the workforce itself. And so that's what trauma-responsive work, I think, is ultimately the goal. Most organizations that we interact with at Cypress are kind of in stages one and two and want to get to three. You know, they know trauma is real. There may be skill building on an individual level to create safe space for folks, but they're trying to do the systems work. They want to look at policies, practices, and procedures, culture building, and with an ultimate goal of, you know, incorporating all of that activity into the institution. But it's, you know, painstaking. It takes time. It takes unified agreement.
So you're explaining that trauma-informed care applies to individual, applies to work force. It also applies to the community. Let's take that kind of one at a time. For an individual, and since this is High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, assuming somebody with a substance use disorder, how does trauma-informed care apply to the treatment of somebody with a substance use disorder?
Yeah, so I think it is about creating safe space, which that phrase gets a lot of attention these days, but I think...
Yeah, what does that mean, safe space?
Right?
Do I need
a lot of questions
area with a little service dog and some, you know, little candy or what?
Yeah. It's a reasonable question. It's a difficult thing to do. We spend a lot of time providing technical assistance and thought partnership to folks who want to learn how to do that, and there's no perfect science to it, right? If there's no what safety means to you and what it means to me might be two different things. You know, we all come to it with different perspectives and lenses. I think there are certain things that we know foster it. So for example, authenticity, I think building trust, being transparent, setting expectations and boundaries and sticking to those, having equitable practice, those sorts of things inform, you know, creating safe space. A lot of folks have talked particularly about psychological safety. What does that mean in an organization, right? Because it's not just about physical safety, having fire extinguishers or exits, that's part of it, but it's also about how do I feel safe here as a whole person? You know, so there's a lot of dialogue going on about how do you actually do that. And what happens is we'll often at Cypress, we'll have a workshop series about that. And then we'll go in and do sessions of technical assistance so that people can try to figure out how am I going to do that here in this particular context with this team that I'm thinking of.
So as far as treatment of somebody with substance use disorder, safe space would be the physical area, right? But also how you talk to the individual and maybe not maybe feel judged, showing that you care. That creates a safe space. Is that what you mean?
Absolutely. Building trust, being transparent. This is what's going to happen. Here's why we're doing that. Explaining the rationale, taking the time to say, like, this is the rule. I'm going to equitably maintain that boundary. Like, there's a lot that goes into building that specifically for someone coming in those conditions. Yeah.
And trauma-informed care, okay, so it includes the safe spaces, but does that mean like, oh, you have an addiction because you had this trauma as a child? Let's psychoanalyze you and figure out what in your childhood had you cover up your pain with drugs?
Yeah, I mean, I think that going back into childhood and connecting dots can be helpful for people to identify coping strategies that maybe they developed that aren't working for them any longer, and trying to replace those with some new coping strategies that could maybe lead to a healthier place. I think it's about working with individuals. One of the things is that there have been some really interesting studies that have said that the constant retelling of the trauma events actually deepens the neural pathway for that event. And so while it is important for people to have their stories told and be acknowledged in that, the constant retelling of it can be an issue. I think of that almost like a record skipping. The goal is to rewrite the narrative, is to rewrite the story. The same way, as we said earlier, the occupational therapist is trying to find a detour, trying to rewrite that narrative. And so just telling the story over and over and over again is actually not particularly helpful. You need to tell the story, have it acknowledged, and then find ways to rewrite that story.
Right. But you do have to tell it. I think right. I think one of the great things Steven Spielberg did for all the generation of Holocaust survivors is he went to them and they had them tell their stories, which they just didn't talk about, didn't tell their children, didn't tell anybody. It was quiet. You like, shh, you don't talk about that. And he was able to get all those people to say their stories. And that's important. But you're saying, okay, but you don't have to like relive it all the time.
It's just it's important to then move into the next step, which would be rewriting that narrative and finding other ways to, move again, same way occupational therapy does. We want to kind of, leverage the brain's ability to find a new way to do something.
So, are you saying that with treatment for substance use disorder, we emphasize a lot on medications, especially in the medical community, because that's what we know. So we always use the tools we know. But I think we also know that if you add that to a behavioral therapy with the medication, things work better. And maybe that's we're not doing enough of that.
I just think that it's going to take more than one tool in a toolbox, right? If you think about this as a complex issue, if I were building a shed, I wouldn't build it with a hammer only. I would need other things to help me do that. I'd need a saw, I'd need, a screwdriver to get the hinges on the door. This is a complex thing that we're attempting to address. And so it's not going to be a one size fits all thing. And it's not what works for one person isn't necessarily going to work for the other, because they're coming preloaded with their own history, their own family's history, and their own lived experience. So all of those things are options, as far as I'm concerned, medication, talk therapy, mindfulness practice, all that. And what I think treatment looks like is helping someone figure out what tools in the toolbox are going to work best for them.
Right. And your point is good because each practitioner has only one tool. Like my tool is a medication. I can do Suboxone, but I don't have all the other tools. And I think if we say addiction's like a chronic disease, you could say it's like, well, if you have cancer, you're not just going to your oncologist. You have your oncologist and your endocrinologist and your chemotherapy session and nutritionist and exercise and mindfulness and mental health and the whole thing for good cancer care. And I think probably the same applies for addiction medicine, and each one has different, not one specialist probably has all that capability, but a good, good care would include all those kind of things, mental health, physical health, trauma-informed care, social services, a whole bunch of things, right? Right.
Absolutely. Absolutely. A holistic pro, often what we say at Cypress is trauma occurs to us holistically, right? So it's not just physical, it's mental, it's emotional, it's social, it's spiritual. If we don't have tools in the toolkit to address all of the ways in which we were harmed, and we are only taking one tool and addressing one of the ways in which we were harmed, it won't be successful.
Yeah. So when I was also intrigued and kind of like looking more about adverse childhood experiences, that the danger is, or the association is, not just with addiction, but any medical illness, right? You could have more susceptibility to not just addiction or depression, but also diabetes or high blood pressure. I thought that was very fascinating.
Yeah, ACEs are directly linked to chronic diseases, loss of life expectancy. That data is all very clear. And again, I would go back to trauma as identified not only as acute trauma or major events, but also living in a set of circumstances that is consistently activating that brain's survival response. So there are lots of folks who, you know, for example, have higher rates of hypertension, right? Communities of color, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that it doesn't take a rocket scientist to connect the dots there and to say, folks are coming preloaded with intergenerational trauma, systems trauma, their own lived experience, we should expect to see higher rates of these chronic diseases.
Yeah, but isn't that more of like a genetic, like there's a family history of coronary artery disease and hypertension.
And combined with the genetic predisposition of trauma and shrinking and unraveling DNA and like all of that. Yeah. And then having it reactivated in lived experience, it's a perfect storm for a lot of folks.
Right. But I mean, I see that component, but we can't like the genetic component, right? I have the BRCA gene for breast cancer. That's not trauma. That's actually the gene.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think it's a both and for me.
Yeah. Interesting. Now, treatment for that. I know, reviewing some of your slides, you said big part of the treatment is rest and a lot of different types of rest. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so we've just been adopting lots of different strategies in our workshops and things, trying to talk to people about all different kinds of things that are out there that they could access. There's lots and lots of great data about sleep and the importance of sleep. There's amazing work that's being done on mindfulness practice and meditative practices and the benefits there, including on that genetic level, which is very exciting. There's work that's done, as you say, on different types of brain rest that the brain needs. So things like creative expression, really connection and the power of connection with another person. There's lots of good stuff, I think, going on. I think for us at Cypress, the main point that we want to make is a lot of times when people have lived experience or they are experiencing really high levels of stress, there's a kind of sing-songy way that people will say, don't forget self-care, right? Like, don't forget to, personal self-care. And it's not to say that personal wellness or personal health is not a critical component of healing, but there also has to be community and collective care, things that we're doing together. Again, I kind of go back to my metaphor of the campfire, right? We were intended to come back to be together with people that we trusted, that were in our crew, and then we were intended to celebrate. And so there is very good data also about connected celebration and community healing practices and the benefit of those. So there's lots of different things out there. Again, I think it's going to be helping people find the tools that are going to work best for them. Oftentimes when we go through some of those things, we have worksheets that people are filling out while we are talking about all these different options, because they're coming up with specific examples from their lives, things that they know are going to work for them, and they're jotting those down while we talk. So I think it's really about, in our workshops, at least co-creating a strategy to support healing. And that may include some of those different types of brain rest. So things like putting that phone down, like we said, like your husband said, the NN rule, right? Making sure that we're connected, that we are connected with people who make us feel safe. personal expression. It could be physical. It could be an art practice. It could be cooking a meal that you love and smelling that. There's lots of different examples that people offer in our classes.
That's great. So now let's switch to the workplace. And I told my audience that there's ACEs for adverse childhood experiences, but I also have, I think for my job as an emergency physician, an adverse career experience. I've had everything kind of happen to me over my career that has not been nice. I've been, you know, assaulted, critiqued. It's a very difficult place to work, spit out. If someone doesn't say the F word to me at least once a shift, then I'm thinking like I'm in the wrong place.
Right, something happened, right?
Right, like I might be. So probably no surprise, the emergency profession is like number one in burnout out of all specialties. And yet I love my job. Tell us a little bit about burnout.
Well, I can say without exaggeration, it's the number one topic that comes up. We train tens of thousands of people a year, which means that we're listening to all different kinds of professionals, people who are on the front lines, on street level, community-based organizations doing work, folks like yourself who are clinicians and working in large health systems or small clinics, public health officials, mental and behavioral health folks, substance use navigators, teachers, you name it. We have been listening for the past 4 years. And burnout's real. And I think that it's, you know, very often spoken of as a workforce or a workplace crisis, because of attrition and early retirements and missed days of work and health issues in the workforce. But I think it's also a public health crisis. And it's, I don't think we're framing it as burnout as a public health crisis in the way that we could be. So yeah, it's top of mind for almost every single person I'm speaking with at this point.
Well, I want to go into that a little bit further of why there is burnout. Again, you mentioned cumulative grief, you know, what we do for a living, moral injury, you know, tell us, you know, what are those words mean?
I think there are a few different factors that are contributing to burnout. Again, kind of a little bit of a perfect storm. I've been working in healthcare workforce in that other program at Public Health Institute for a long time, for 13 years. And I've been involved in a lot of workforce discussions. There has been a longstanding focus and goal of diversifying the health workforce, right? Making sure that we have trusted messengers, that people from the community are serving the community. Well, if that's true and that's something that we really want, then those folks are coming preloaded with some of that intergenerational trauma that we talked about, right? Some of the systems trauma that we talked about. You mentioned your own family, right? Like that October 7, we saw that and it activated us, right? You know, that's very real. So we want a multilingual, multicultural workforce, but then that means certain things in terms of the intergenerational experience of those people. We know, for example, that we want empathy in the workforce. That's a huge thing. Everyone talks about empathy. Brené Brown's done great work on the difference between empathy and sympathy. So I want to build my empathetic skills, which means I actually connect to you, right? And we're connecting here. We've been talking already today about trust, transparency, building safe space. That means I'm present with you in a very real way. We're connected. So that's leaves me vulnerable. Then we experience vicarious and secondary trauma. Vicarious and secondary trauma is the trauma we experience on the job, walking with those people as they experience trauma, being in that room, in your case, when they are experiencing trauma, listening to the family outside the room and what they're going through and the person on the gurney, all of that, listening to their stories. So we've got intergenerational lived experience, our empathy, then we experience cumulative grief, right? So all of that is compounding over time. It's almost like damming up. And then on top of that, moral injury. And that is the frustration and pain and anger that folks feel when they're trying to help a person or a community and they feel like their hands are tied. The way I hear that a lot in conversation with folks is, I was trying to help this person and I need to get them off the street. And I found out they no longer qualify for that program and I can't get them in.
That's the day to day.
It's the day to day. It's like, I feel like I'm wrapped in duct tape. Someone told me recently, I can't do any of the things that I know I should be doing. You take all of that together and then you ask yourself, how are we supporting the people doing that work?
Right. I like that. And in the emergency department, it seems like throughout my career, I'm always like defending the ER doctors. I'll go to a meeting and it'll be like, oh, they screwed up here and they treated bad here. And we're they say the emergency department is like practicing the fishbowl. Everybody criticizes what you do. From in the hospital and patients and then, you know, also public meetings. When it comes to addiction medicine, they'll say, oh, you know, people aren't treated well in the emergency department and you know, and they don't like visiting there. And I think a lot of that has to do with exactly what you're talking about. It's frustration. It's like, okay, you're homeless. What am I supposed to do?
Right.
Like, what can I do? I have no tools. You know, so... because we care. I think people say, oh, they don't care. It's like, yeah, we do care. Why would we be in this profession if we don't? I mean, like, we sacrificed a lot of money, time, energy, enjoyment in order to get to this profession. We didn't do that because we didn't care about people. We did that because we care. And now we're in a situation where, like, there's nothing I can do. We want to fix things and we can't. And turning that around of like, well, we got to teach those ER doctors to have less stigma. It's like, no, maybe we need to acknowledge the moral injury that they're going through and the cumulative grief that they're going through because they do care and they're frustrated and give them tools.
Yeah. Well, remember what we said earlier about the neural pathway of trauma is deeper in the brain, the more helpless we feel when the things are happening. Mm-hmm. Right. So what are you talking about? You're talking about institutional helplessness, a sense of systemic helplessness. How can I help this person? What can I do? And so living with that and grieving that and feeling all the complex feelings about that is a lot to ask a person to hold without support.
Right. And I don't think that we even know that we're going through that because we're seeing 30 patients in a shift and we don't even it's like, okay, sending you home. It's like, how many homeless people did you just send to the street? Like a lot, because I had no choice. That's what I had to do. I don't even think they even know that most people know that they have this trauma. It's just part of the job.
Well, and what happens, or at least what folks are telling me is happening to them, is that the joy and the passion that they brought to the work initially is being taken from them, and they are grieving the loss of the joy and the passion for the job. So I hear a lot of people saying, this isn't why I got into this. This isn't like I used to love my job and I want to love my job again, but I don't know how. People will kind of confess in the direct messages a lot of things about this feeling. It's not just frontline health professionals. We see the same sorts of things in education. Teachers will say the same things. People working in community-based organizations, people in public health. It doesn't really.
You mentioned librarians. It's like, what? They live in a quiet librarian, little place. How do they have? What kind of stress does a librarian have?
So much stress. Yeah, we've been working with librarians, and they have a lot going on in the library. All of the things that you mentioned, assault, being spit on, like all the things, that's happening in the library.
Is that just a California phenomenon where our libraries became like centers for homeless people?
Well, because of that, like homeless people don't just live in California either, right? So I do think that that is a contributing factor. But I also think that any profession that's working with the public right now is experiencing really high levels. Our second most requested workshop at Cypress right now is de-escalation. People need tools to help de-escalate situations in the workplace.
Right. And that, what kind of workplace? Not just health, you said?
Everything. Pretty much anything. Public transit, business associations, within companies, public health departments, you name it. It's not just those kind of people that one would assume are dealing with this issue. It's kind of everybody.
Interesting. So we talked about cumulative grief, moral injury. What's toxic stress? How is that different than regular stress?
I think it's just a toxic level, you know? I mean,
it's just the quantity.
Yeah, I mean, so when you look at, again, sort of just what happens in the body, I mean, stress chemicals are a normal part of our day. They're needed. That's what the brain releases to get us up in the morning. The alarm goes off. I need to get my coffee, walk the dog. I call them gas pedal chemicals. In order to move the car, you have to hit the gas a little bit. They're necessary for us. But at too high a level, they are damaging. The same way I can't really effectively drive a car, just, you know, like constantly hitting the gas and putting the metal, what do they say?
Pedal to the metal.
Pedal to the metal. Exactly. Like doing that or screeching on the brakes. That's not an effective way to drive. Right. So I think that's what happens is people get, they're revving too high and then their bodies are going to swing them in the other direction.
Sounds like someone on methamphetamines.
Yeah, it kind of, I have to tell you, like people, again, talk to us and disclose things to us. And it is not uncommon to hear people sort of like feeling as though they're humming at like a 30 or a 40, and they're having a really hard time getting back down to calm. An example of that is it's a time of year when a lot of people might go on vacation. And I hear all the time, I took a week off, Brooke. I really wanted to, you know, take care of myself and I needed that break. I took the week off and about day 4 or 5, I started to relax. And then I got 1 or 2 days of actual calm and relaxation and I had to come back. That's a very common story.
Had to come back to
work. You know, like I just.
Yeah, but that's helpful. But that's helpful. Those 4, you know, at least it's something.
It's something, sure. But I think that what it tells me is that it's taking people a very long time to actually get down to a state of relaxation.
Yeah. I think everybody who works in the emergency department does that. Because yeah. You go, 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 go. I feel like working is like a marathon. And then you can't just like shut it off. You have to, you know. I think the drive home actually helps.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm glad to hear that. Like, yeah, the drive home is important. Yeah.
And I help.
I have been really interested in what you asked about earlier, which is if we know that burnout is real, if we understand that toxic levels of stress are real for the workforce, how can we build systems and conditions to support the workforce knowing that this is going to be real for them? How do we prepare people for that? How do we build in breaks in a different way? All of those things that we talked about
earlier. I've seen some institutions, very few, who have been able to kind of do that. And again, nothing's 100%. I think a big part of it is bringing people what you mentioned of like why you have this passion in the first place, why taking you back to why did you become a nurse or a doctor or want to work in a hospital or whatever it is, work in a library in the first place, remind people of that and not just a one-off, not just like, okay, we got a seminar, here's a class and now, but they continue to do that as a day-to-day practice and give more positive feedback on a regular basis. Like that, the culture is positive feedback because we get negative feedback.
Yeah, it sounds
They
like.
answered a bad Yelp review. I remember when I was the director of the emergency department, I'd always get these like, okay, answer these bad Yelp reviews. And I was like, you know what? I don't want to hear another request for me to answer something bad without two positives. I want two positives to every negative. And
Yeah, that seems reasonable. The organizations that you know that are doing that well, you're saying they kind of lead with gratitude and positivity, and then
Yeah,
sort of
taking you back to
gratitude.
why you have that profession, and then and have that reflect. I mean, you know, they have posters everywhere, and it's not just a one seminar thing. It's they constantly do that on a regular basis, and then that becomes transparent to the staff, and then that automatically comes to like the patients or what you're doing at work.
That makes a lot of sense.
It's not like, you know, don't have stigma against these patients, or you know, or you have to do, you know, be nice to the patients. It'd be more like we value you as employees and stuff, and then that automatically translates, you know, to the patients. So,
Yeah, that sounds really important. And culture building can make a significant difference.
yeah.
Yeah,
So, is
absolutely.
that what you do for now organizations?
We do lots of things for organizations. I
Yeah,
mean,
tell us about that.
some of it is, so something, for example, like mental health first aid certification. That's just a good.
What is that?
Yeah, so it's kind of like first aid or CPR for mental health. So it helps people identify the early signs and symptoms of a mental health challenge. How do I approach that subject with a person in the early stages? How do I support them as they may be trying to access care, all the way to following the trajectory to crisis? So how do I handle an overdose? How do I handle someone's thoughts of suicide? What do I do if I find out they're self-harming, right? So it's a whole kind of escalation.
Don't you have to have, I think the basis of that is trust, right? Because during the COVID pandemic, they said, okay, you know, ER people, they must be stressed out during, you know, when we were the front line people for that, everybody else was at home. And so they must have stress. So we want them to come to administration and tell us we need more of your people. It's like, you know, I'm not gonna Right, go to you and do that. We want to turn people in. You know, there has to be a basis, a different basis for that.
No, I think mental health first aid is just it's a good box to check for both outward facing practice, but also keeping an eye on each other, because it's really about building that culture of it's okay to not be okay. It's not about ratting anyone out. It's about how do I approach that conversation if I'm concerned about you. So if I was like, Dr. Lev's just like not acting like herself lately, and I'm gonna walk closer to that and let her know I'm here and let her know that I have her back. And if she ever wanted to talk, I'm gonna be around, and that I'm gonna be consistent in that. For me, mental health first aid is trying to avoid crisis. It's trying to not have a crisis situation come to the forefront. And if you came to me and said, actually, I'm having thoughts of killing myself, I would want to know how to react, right? So, it's a training that I think in an organization is just a good box to check to always just make sure, like you would for CPR. X percent of our people are always MHFA certified. It's just a good thing to do.
I have to think about that a little bit, because CPR, you're like dead. Okay, if you're by the time you need, I'd rather have, frankly, I'd rather invest in a population. I mean, CPR, knowing CPR is good. I'm not going to say that's not bad, but avoiding CPR in the first place,
Yeah,
to
absolutely. That's the goal.
junior,
That's always the
you
goal.
know, like so, or you know, so actually, first aid or before getting to CPR, maybe even more important, and
Yeah, it's an 8-hour training. The majority of the training is trying to prevent crisis.
Yeah, right. Just having a positive culture in the first place, where you're always asking about each other, right? Not wait for a crisis to then ask.
Exactly. But I think in the workplace, especially, or maybe a friend or a family member, that can be a feel like a really different conversation. There's a lot of other stuff that comes into it. I may, you know, in my, with my work hat on, feel really comfortable asking, hey, how's it going? I've noticed some changes, but that may change for me pretty significantly if it's a kid or my niece or my neighbor or someone else like that. So it's, you know, we really talk through with people, how do you approach that conversation in the early stages? Because the goal, of course, as you said, is always to avoid crisis. We don't ever want to get anyone to thoughts of suicide. That's not right.
And if you only wait until there's a problem to say something, then it's, then it seems disingenuous, right? Then it's like, okay, you're just trying to get me in trouble in my workplace.
Yeah.
But if it was, but if you're only asking how I'm doing when you think that there's a problem, then you feel like you're in trouble at work rather than if it's part of the culture to care.
Yeah. And again, that's why I always say it's really helpful to have X percent of people that are always skill building in this area, because then you are building that culture. But I think like if we're not talking about it at all and no one feels comfortable approaching a concern or having that dialogue or saying, hey, I'm here if you ever want to talk, then now we're more likely to get to a crisis. Right.
Yeah.
So, Brooke, give us your commercial for organizations who should be reaching out to you. How do they reach out to you? What do you provide?
Yeah, so we have a whole host of trainings. We do trainings in grief, like how to support folks who are grieving. We do all forms of mental health first aid certification. There's lots of different forms. We do all of our trauma trainings. We do workshops and sessions on all the things we discussed today, whether it's neurobiology or burnout. You know, there's a whole spectrum and menu of services we provide. Lately, what we've been doing as well is retreat facilitation. We've been doing a lot of sessions of technical assistance where we're really becoming thought partners for organizations. How do I apply all of this here? Really thinking about that culture change you're talking about, thinking about those policies and practices and procedures. We have been really deepening the work and will continue to deepen the work as it relates to young people and supporting young people right now, but also folks who are aging. And we have an aging population, and so we're building some new work around that. And we've been doing a lot more leadership coaching, how to be a trauma responsive leader, whether that's on a team as a supervisor or manager or in a larger context. And folks can find us just at cypressresilience.org. Of course, we're on social media in a variety of ways, but you can always just go to the website and sign up for the newsletter, and you'll find out all the new things we've got going on.
That's great. Trauma-informed care, Cypress Resilience. And we want trauma-informed care for individuals, for organizations, and it makes the world a kinder, nicer place.
It's possible, which is the really good thing, right? Like we always want to know, is this going to really work or not? Great news is neuroscience tells us it will. So that's good.
Important individuals. And also, I think people, it's amazing. People would be willing to take less pay to work in a place that's friendly.
Yeah.
That they feel good working at.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Good.
Thank you so much, Brooke.
Oh, thanks for having me. It was wonderful to speak with you today. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to FAF, Families Against Fentanyl. Visit familiesagainstfentanyl.org to learn more. High Truths producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I am your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths.